Hello and welcome to episode 23 of the Help Side Basketball Coaching Analytics Podcast. I'm your host, John Jansen, head men's basketball coach at La Sierra University here in Riverside, California. And I am coming to you today shocked. The Clippers have just been knocked out of the playoffs. I wanted to do a podcast before we got to the Western Conference and Eastern Conference Finals. Obviously, game one of Miami and Boston happened earlier today as well, but I cannot believe the outcome of this Clipper. On today's podcast, we will catch up on the NBA and what's going on in the playoffs. We will talk a little bit about flopping because I'm again over it and I want to rant again. In the analytics section, we're going to talk about offensive rebounding and a very interesting article that I read. And in the strategy session, we're going to talk about Denver's offense and how they were able to break down the Clippers here in Game 7 and take the series from them. So let's get into it. The first thing, we'll start from the beginning here, and we'll start in the West, and we'll talk about the Lakers and the Rockets. I was never a fan of them getting rid of Clint Capela and going to the small ball in Houston. I thought he was a good piece for them. He was able to defend the other team's big guys. He was able to finish around the basket. He was able to play pick and roll effectively and get James Harden in some positive and Russell Westbrook in some positive matchups. And by going small, look, they felt it was the only way they could be different. You know, if everyone's going big, you go small. If everyone's going small, you go big. I get it. But it just doesn't seem like it's the way with that team, because if you want to play like that, you have to play really fast, you got to move the ball, and you got to be faster than the other team. And while they did play fast sometimes, they also slowed the ball down a lot. James Harden would stand and dribble in place. And we've talked about this before in previous podcasts. The minute you stop, everyone resets. So the whole point is moving the ball quickly, moving it around the perimeter, drive and kick, redrive, re-kick, and you have the defense on their heels. Well, the problem is when one guy stands and dribbles, all of these guys that might have been out of position in switches because they close out on somebody, all of them can now switch back, reset, and now you've put yourself in a non-positive situation. So for that kind of team playing small ball like D'Antoni did with the Phoenix Suns, they went really fast. And this team didn't play really fast, and I think that's kind of what hurt them. You know, they wanted to be anti-normal with the big guys, but they didn't, in my opinion, play it effectively. And I really didn't like the Lakers switching the starting lineup and taking JaVale McGee out, because I thought they were almost starting to play Houston's way. But I was wrong. I mean, obviously the Lakers have the worst of the Morrises, and he actually made a lot of shots, and that was huge because it gave them these extra points, and it also helped on the defensive end. So it ended up working out correctly. I hope they go back to their original lineup here against Denver, because I just think that this long, athletic lineup is just so hard to score in the paint against, because they're so long and so athletic, and they can rim protect. D'Antoni not coming back, you know, he didn't decide this. He didn't make these trades. He did the best with what he was given to him, and I think he did an excellent job. I understand that they're moving on because they've kind of peaked as far as how far they can probably get, but I think that has more to do with the roster than the coach, because if you bring in another coach, is he going to play a traditional offense? Well, you can't play traditional offense with no size. So D'Antoni was, in my opinion, doing the best he could with that roster because of his style. And now if you bring in a coach who plays with a regular style, well, now you have to go back to the drawing board and somehow get some of these bigger guys. So I don't know what they're going to do. I've seen a few names out there, but again, it's very confusing because they don't have a roster to play a traditional style with a traditional coach. I love that the Lakers stopped playing J.R. Smith and Dion Waiters. I think they were just messing with us during those 8 games. I think they were probably just saying, okay, we got the number one seed, and what we can do is we can just buy minutes with these guys. Who cares if we lose? And we'll just turn it on in the playoffs. And while that's terrifying for fans, LeBron has been able to do that throughout his career and get his teams going. And he and now Rondo's back, and it seems like the Lakers are starting to click. And as we get to the conference finals and then hopefully the finals, they look like they're a team that's on the rise, which is great. Going to the East, the Bucks lose to Miami. I couldn't believe it. And it's funny because as soon as the Bucks were playing Miami, I was like, oh no, this is a bad matchup. And you didn't even think about it beforehand. But Miami can score, and the Bucks really struggle to score. And, you know, everyone just discounted losing Brogdon. But that's 17 points, that's very hard to replace. And it's also a knockdown shooter. And it's a playmaker in addition to Giannis, where, you know, okay, yes, they have Bledsoe, yes, they have Hill, but Brogdon can knock down an open three. He can get to the middle of the paint and create for other people. And it just takes a little pressure off Giannis to score and distribute and do all this stuff. And without him, you're taking away one of the main scorers, and you're really limiting yourself offensively just for the whole season. And I know they had the best record in the NBA, but that's a team that's built to win in the regular season. It's a team that's built to pick on bad teams, and that's what they did. They are just better than most teams, and they were a team that doesn't take nights off, and they go out there and they play hard and they get victories. But when you're in a grinded out, or in this case against Miami, a speeded up series where they just can't score enough, then they're going to be in trouble. And all credit to Miami. I mean, you know, they have just enough on defense, and they got some guys who can put the ball in the hole. You know, they got all the shooters, Robinson, Hero, and then Dragic, and then Butler, who's kind of their guy. And then Bam is playing great as well. So they really have a nice team. I don't know how far they can go with this, but already they've done really good to get here to the East Finals. And then Boston, they don't look pretty, but they always play really hard, and that's been a good part about Brad Stevens as a coach. They always play hard. He maximizes the talent. He uses them to the best of their abilities, and he's taken, you know, teams that shouldn't be this good and gone as far as he could possibly go with them. And I think look, this is not a championship roster that he has here. It's a very good roster, but it's not a championship roster. And it's very possible and very likely that they'll make it to the NBA Finals. And again, he's overshot his talent, and that's amazing. And, you know, they're still one or two guys away from being a legitimate championship team. But again, he's done a fantastic job as usual. And when you get this far, and I'm going to get to this even more in a minute, the coaching is so huge. And I think the world of Spoelstra, and I think the world of Brad Stevens, I think they're two of the best coaches in the NBA. I put them right there with Pop and with Rick Carlisle as the best coaches in the NBA. And those are and even Stotts in Portland, you know, he maximizes his talent as, you know, really well too. But I think that Spoelstra and Brad Stevens are two of the best coaches in the league, and here you go. You see they out-scheme teams with possibly more talent, and they get the best out of their team, and they do the best they can. I mean, Eric Spoelstra has taken nobody teams really far year after year, and it's just very impressive. When we go to I really think that Boston wins this. I know they lost today, but they gave away a 15-point lead in the fourth quarter, and I really didn't like how they played the fourth quarter. It ended up being Kemba or Tatum just went one-on-one every single possession, and the other guys just kind of stood around, and they really didn't even pass. It's not even like they drove and kicked to those guys. They just literally stood there and did nothing. I mean, it was just bad offense. And then I thought Tatum really forced. You know, Kemba finally made a few shots, and then Tatum goes air ball, terrible fall away. Kemba gets blocked, and then Tatum takes the last shot at the end of regulation. And you're just like, these are just terrible shots. You know, maybe if you have Jimmy Butler on you, then you know what? You let somebody else go. You let somebody else who has a better plus matchup go at their guy. Or you run real offense. And, you know, it's so funny to me that the way to win for 45 minutes is to run offense and play basketball, and then the last 3 minutes, it's give it to one guy and have him go one-on-one every single time. Why does it change? Why in the last minute, the last 2 minutes, the last 3 minutes, is it no longer effective to play the right way where we have to just go one-on-one? Why can't we still run our offense? I don't understand that. And you see it, and now you see, you know, like with guys like Kawhi Leonard who are elite one-on-one scorers, that's great. And Kemba's a very good one-on-one scorer, but when you're matched up against Jimmy Butler or an elite defender, you know, the edges are so small that it's probably not even worth it. You probably should just run your regular offense and get a great shot. And if it happens to be Marcus Smart or somebody else, then that's the way it is. But I don't like the one-on-one standing in place and waiting the 5 seconds on the shot clock and trying to make something happen. It's, to me, it's not winning basketball. And I think they got burned today. Going back to the West, I really think this is a good matchup for the Lakers. I know it seemed like it would be a good matchup for the Clippers, but I think the Lakers are too big and too strong and too good across the board for these guys, and I'm hoping they'll use their length. I think that the Lakers can do a much better job on the Joker, Jokic, and you know, they can shoot just as well. They have LeBron versus Murray and Jokic versus Anthony Davis, and I think those could be a wash, and if they are, I think the Lakers have a great chance because the rest of their team is much better than the rest of the Denver Nuggets guys. And we'll get into why the Nuggets were effective in the strategy session. Talking about coaching, you know, I think Frank Vogel's a solid coach, and now Malone has really, really maximized the talent here by getting this Denver team to the West Finals, which is really impressive, down 3-1 in two consecutive series. They just didn't give up. And, you know, they dominated the second half in the last couple of games, which is amazing, over a really good Clipper team. So now I'm going to spend 2 minutes talking about Doc Rivers. And, look, I don't want to get too personal, but I just think he's an overrated coach. He started in Orlando. He was fired. He went to Boston. They were awful with a Hall of Famer, Paul Pierce. And he was about to be fired again and probably out of coaching. And then Ray Allen and Paul Pierce and Rajon Rondo fall into his lap. He has those four guys, along with Kendrick Perkins, and just the best role players for 3 years, and they win one championship. And in my opinion, that is as much of an underperformance and under-maximizing of your talent and your opportunity that you can get. And then he takes over for Vinny Del Negro in LA, and they had been a 4-5 seed every year, and they were 4-5 seed every year with him. And he took the prime of Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and that team, who was loaded with talent, loaded with role players, and they never made the Western Conference Finals, and they blew leads. And now he becomes the third coach to blow a 3-1 lead in the playoffs. The first coach to blow a three. He was the only coach to blow a 3-1 lead twice. Now he's the first coach to blow a 3-1 lead three times. And then, you know, you get Paul George, you get Kawhi Leonard, you have this unbelievable roster. Like, as a Laker fan, I thought the Lakers had no chance against the Clippers. I was rooting so hard for the Nuggets today because the depth, the talent, the playmaking, the scoring. I mean, the Clippers have everything. And yet here we are again talking about a Doc Rivers team with a ton of talent underperforming again. And I don't understand why I'm the only one who thinks this. I don't understand why everyone else thinks he's a great coach. I understand he won a championship, but that's fine. Phil Jackson won, you know, a lot more with talent. I mean, people with talent are supposed to win. And he has all the talent in the world. And you know, another thing is I think he's the biggest complainer coach in the NBA, and I think it really takes away from the focus of his team. And I've said it for years, and you look at Chris Paul, who before he came to the Clippers was on the Pelicans or the Hornets or whatever their name was back then. He wasn't a complainer. Sam Cassell, his assistant coach. Tyronn Lue, his assistant coaches. These guys were not complainers, and now you see them on the bench whining and complaining about every single call. And then they get one call back, and I'm sure Doc goes, yeah, I got you. I got that one. But it's so takes away from the focus. It so takes away from the team's focus because they're thinking about it. Look, I've coached with – I can specifically think of one person, And all he did was complain to the ref. And this was a long time ago. And he complained and he complained and he complained. And then his whole team would complain. And everybody was just focused on the refs every single game. And I just was like, no, you can't do that. And then, you know, it was a club team, so we had multiple teams. And then he would sit on the bench for my team. And I just didn't want him there because I did not want him arguing with the ref. And I would turn and say, hey, don't worry about the refs. Let's just win this game. And to me, it's I've always tried to keep my talking to the refs a personal, you know, small thing. And when my assistants get on the refs, I turn and tell them to stop because I don't want the players thinking about it. I don't want the players thinking they're getting cheated. You know, mindset is so huge. You know, your focus is so huge. And if a player thinks he's getting cheated now, his mindset is negative. His mindset is against the referee. Now he's looking for reasons to believe that the refs are against him. And you just got to be tough. And some days you're not going to get the calls and you just got to be tougher. And some days you're going to get the calls and that's great. But I think it's really important not to focus on the referees. And I think that that's a big problem with Doc. And obviously, look, he's an NBA coach. I'm a nobody. So it's just my opinion. Last thing I want to talk about before we move on is flopping, and I've talked about it before. And man, even with football starting this week, you know, you saw, for those who are football fans, AJ Green get called for a push off, and then in the Sunday night game, Michael Gallup getting called for a push off, and these ended the games, and both their teams lost. And the announcers even said in the Ram game, "Oh, he sold that one, Jalen Ramsey. He sold that one." And it's just like, first of all. And this is huge in the NBA. I mean, in the NBA, everyone's flopping. Every possession, someone's flopping. They're either falling down, or if they get screened, they're flailing their arms like it's an illegal screen, or if they get bumped, they're jerking their neck back. And it's awful. Number one, it ruins the game. It slows the game down. It's extra calls. It just ruins the flow of the game. Number two, it's clear that they're all flopping. And the thing is, like, how are these refs so bad that they can't realize that these guys are flopping? I mean, I've reffed before. When I was younger, I used to ref. I've played my whole life. I've coached. You can tell when someone's flopping. I'm standing there. I know they say the game goes fast. Well, guess what? I'm on the sidelines. I'm in the game. I know what a flop is. Okay? The fact that these referees cannot figure out what a flop is, all you have to do is just stop calling flops and they'll stop doing it immediately. And the same goes for these guys who are jumping into people. I mean, this is probably my number one pet peeve with the NBA, and even now they do it in college a little bit. If you jump and then a player jumps sideways so he hits you, then they call an offense or they call it a foul and you get free throws. And it's just so ridiculous. And these shots are not even real shots. They will never go in. It's these guys literally trying to manipulate the rules in order to get free throws, and it's just so stupid. They should change the rule. It's so simple. Adam Silver, I know you're listening. Just change the rule and say, if it is not your normal shot in the referee's discretion and you jump into a player and it's not your normal shot, then we're not going to call it. And guess what? Immediately it'll be over. The first guy will do it. There won't be a call. The next guy will do it. There won't be a call. The third guy will do it. There won't be a call. And no one will ever do it again because they'll see it's not going to work out. Now they look stupid because they just airballed a shot. Because they really didn't get fouled, and the refs are stopping or no longer calling these stupid fouls. And it's over. And it's so simple. So Adam Silver, please, starting next year, put that in. I appreciate it. It makes the game way more enjoyable. I mean, it's so funny because everybody on the other team complains when they make this call. And then they go down to the other end, and then the other guy does it, and they call it again. And then everybody on the other team complains. It's like so dumb. You know, it's just like, I wish even the player could get together and say, hey, let's just not do this anymore. Because it's not the way basketball is meant to be played. You're not supposed to manipulate so you can try to get free throws. It's really sad. Okay, rant over. Moving on to the analytics section. I read a very interesting article on offensive rebounding. And if you want to check it out, it's on a website called squared2020.com. I have no affiliation with them. I was just online, you know, trying to become a better coach. And I ran across this article. And before I get into the article, I probably spend a few hours a week online trying to become a better coach, whether it's reading articles, watching videos, watching game film, whatever the case may be. And I really think that's important. And if it's something you're not doing, then if you're not moving forward, then people are passing you up because you're standing still. And especially in this COVID time where, you know, we couldn't be on the court, you know, we couldn't use our coaching in real life, this is the time to get better, you know, in your house, on your own. This is practice. This is you putting up 500 shots a day when you were younger, you know? That's what watching film and reading articles is all about. You know, I know they did Zoom meetings during COVID coaching clinics, and I know people, I have friends who did those. And all you had to do was kind of search for them, and I participated in one of those. I didn't do it as much as I should have, but, you know, it's not good enough to just say, okay, I'm a good enough coach. Because if you think you're good enough, let me tell you something, you're not. Because everybody else is learning, everybody else is getting better, everybody else is adding to their craft, and you need to keep doing that as well. So anyway, I read this article, and it's talking about offensive rebounding. And it's charting NBA offensive rebounding. And I'll just get to the synopsis of the article. It says that offensive rebounding is a negative overall play. So what they're saying is the teams that most aggressively offensive rebounded gave up 4.2 points per game more than teams that did not offensive rebound or aggressively offensive rebound. And what it said was basically by pulling your guys into the basket. Now, it's not talking about guys who are already in the paint. Those guys are supposed to be offensive rebounding. But a lot of coaches and say that you're supposed to attack the offensive glass. If you're the three-point line, you should be sprinting in going for an offensive rebound. And this article, based on, you know, hundreds and thousands of, you know, possessions, and has realized that by pulling those guys in, what you're doing is when you don't get the offensive rebound, your guys are in no man's land because now they have to turn and sprint back while the ball is getting thrown or dribbled by them. And now you're creating a very negative matchup for your defense where the other team in transition is going to score at a higher rate than you are going to score by offensive rebounding. So it's very interesting to think about that. It doesn't say not offensive rebounding, but already just from reading this article, I was thinking to myself, okay, so if we got two guys already in the paint, they should offensive rebound. And then maybe one guy should run across around the free throw line area, and then the other two should get back. And if that guy at the free throw line, you know, if the ball is not a long rebound, he should start heading back as well. Because what they're saying is that by having these guys crash, their offensive, you know, the guys who are on defense who turn to offense when the defense gets the rebound are now running past them as they're running in, and now it's creating easy baskets the other way. And look, you can say 4.2 points per game is not a lot, but why would you have anything that has a negative overall outcome? I mean, that doesn't make any sense, you know? So does that mean I'm going to abandon offensive rebounding? Of course not. And now what's also interesting about this article is they charted where shots missed, and starting with close to the basket and moving their way out to the three-point line. And what's very interesting about this, and let me scroll to it so I make sure that I'm expressing it correctly. So when a guy shoots a three-pointer, and this is an NBA, these are NBA statistics, okay? So it's going to be different at the college level or the high school level, but it's something that I'm guessing would be similar across the board. When someone shoots a three-pointer, the spray chart of the misses is pretty random. Now, pretty random as in there's no area that has more than anywhere else. So people miss long, they miss short, there's long rebounds, but there's no area that has a more, you know, more clustered area, okay? Now, when you move one step inside the three-point line, it becomes very obvious that people miss short. Why is that? Because a couple reasons. Number one, it's usually like a dribble pull-up, and they mentioned that in the article. You're ball faking, you're taking one dribble in, and you're on the move. People usually, you know, especially as we get to lower levels, high school and college, guys and girls are not going to be as good coming off a one dribble pull-up. It's just a much more difficult shot. You probably have a guy that just flew by you or you drove by or you're or he's on your hip, and so it's going to be a much more difficult shot. And because of that, it's missed short at a very high rate and much higher than missing long. Now, of course, there's still long rebounds. Some miss long, of course, but the cluster is on short, okay? Then when you come in for a 15-footer or a mid-range shot, I would say, it's very, very spread out, meaning in for three-pointers, a lot of misses are around the basket, in the paint, in the charge circle area. But when you're around a mid-range, it's very, very spread out. There's not even a cluster underneath the basket. And the question is, why would that be? And the answer is because it's a shot that isn't practiced as much, isn't shot as much. And again, you're probably going to be in traffic. There's probably going to be people around. You're not going to just be wide open. And so it's a shot that has a very high amount of variance. And then the last one they looked at was in the paint shots, but not dunks. So you're talking about floaters, you're talking about little mid-range shots in the paint, and those had a longer, while there was a bunch that missed around the basket, there was also some long rebounds on that as well. And those tended to miss on the long side. So what does that mean? That means that maybe we shouldn't be not offensive rebounding. Maybe we should be offensive rebounding with a purpose or with a strategy, right? Because we always say, hey, go crash the boards. And I've always been a proponent of go to the weak side. Now, in college, I was the number one rebounder in my conference. And as a guard that they forced into a post position because I grew, I was not a natural post player. I did work hard, but I always like to be on the weak side. And the reason I like to be on the weak side is because I could see the flight of the ball. And I could start moving to where I knew the rebound was going to be based on the flight of the ball, right? We've all rebounded for somebody. And you know, if you stand on the weak side and you can see the ball going in, you know where to go. Well, I would look and see, and this isn't, you know, something that I invented, or this is, everybody knows this, but when you're on the weak side, you can see the flight of the ball. And if you are, you know, smart, or, you know, if you can predict, you can know where that offensive rebound is going. And that's what I would do. I would see the ball where it was coming, and I'd start moving to where I knew it was already going to go before it even got there. And so sometimes I'd be moving away from the basket as the ball's coming in because I knew it was going to hit the heel of the rim, and I would go and have a great opportunity to get that rebound. So I've always taught, go to the weak side. If you can't get to the weak side, then get to the strong side. And if you can't get to the strong side, then get anywhere where you can get space near the basket. You know, like let's say there's two people kind of standing, one on the strong side, one on the weak side. Well, then go to the middle because now you can get those rebounds. You know, you want to take the space that's available. There's no point in running to the weak side and running right behind a guy because now you're only going to get the long rebound. So I've always taught that. Now, looking at this, it seems that going to the weak side, sorry, to the short side, which is the strong side, would be the best strategy because when they shoot threes, the spray chart is pretty even. Some miss short, some miss long, some miss long rebounds. When it's a one dribble pull-up, it looks like most of the time it misses short. So if you're on the short side, which is the strong side, excuse me, then you'll have the short ones from the threes and then a higher percentage of the one dribble pull-ups. Now, if you see your teammate driving in these graphs, it said that they miss long. So what we can kind of infer from this, and look, it's team by team. Maybe you have a team who shoots differently. You'd have to kind of chart that or kind of watch it or eye it. But if you have a guy driving, you tell your guys to start crashing to the weak side. If you have a guy on the three-point line, tell your guys to crash to the strong side. And especially if they take that one dribble pull up, that's much more likely that's going to miss short. So I find this article very interesting. It kind of makes me rethink things. It kind of makes me think, don't send that third guy to the rim because it's a negative proposition. Now, once again, as we've talked about with everything in here in our analytics, it depends on the matchup. if they are a tiny team or if they're the Houston Rockets in the NBA and they don't rebound well, then of course you're going to want to send your guys to the rim. But we're talking about a regular team, a good boxing out team, et cetera, et cetera. That would be a situation where you don't maybe send that third guy to the offensive glass. Or you don't send guys from the three-point line to the offensive glass. If they're already in there, then of course they should be going for the offensive rebounds because they're right there. But you don't want to send that third guy in because it puts you in a negative situation. So it's something to look at. Squared2020.com if you're interested. It's nothing to do with me. I'm going to be probably quoting from a lot of different websites that I find cool stuff on. And that's just something that I learned. Last thing I want to talk about, strategy session time, is Denver's offense against the Clippers here and what they did and what I think the Clippers could have done better. And again, as I'm watching any basketball game, any soccer game, any football game, I'm always thinking of it as a coach. And my friends will tell you that that's not as fun to watch with me because I'm talking about strategy the whole time, or I'm making the call before the ref does because I see it. But I'm really watching the game as a coach, and that's just the way it is. And so I'm watching this Clipper game, and this game 7 tonight, and game 6, and all these other games, and looking and going, well, what are the Clippers doing that's working, and what's the Clippers doing that's not working, and vice versa for both teams. So the first thing, and I'm just going to talk about game 7 here today. It's fresh. Everybody saw it, hopefully, and hopefully you guys will be getting this tonight or tomorrow morning, and it'll be fresh in your mind. So in the first half, the Clippers were built up, I think, a 10 or 12 point lead. And they double teamed Jokic when he got the ball on the post. They double teamed Murray on the perimeter. And basically, Denver did the exact same thing the entire game. The difference is in the first half, Denver didn't make any shots besides for Murray. I mean, Jokic made a couple, but basically Murray was the only one who made a shot. And so what would happen is they double-team Murray. He drops the ball off to Jokic. Jokic takes one dribble, looks around, finds a wide-open shooter at the three-point line, and those guys took shots, and they were missing. Or Jokic got the ball on the post. They came over and doubled him. He found a wide-open guy. They took a shot and missed. Now, the problem with this is that was variance, and that was negative variance. Those are professional shooters. They're on the floor in game 7 because they can knock down an open shot. But they didn't, and so the Clippers had the lead. Then you see Murray go, well, that's enough of that, and he just took over, and he got hot. And I said to my friends, I was texting my friends at halftime, Clippers are going to win this game by 20. Because there's no way that Murray can keep this up. Well, unfortunately for the Clippers, I believe they overreacted to Murray's first half. They said, okay, now in the second half, we are going to double team Murray every time he either has the ball or he comes off a ball screen. And they did that. And he barely scored. He scored a little bit. I think he probably had 13 maybe in the second half, something like that. Maybe some free throws at the end. But what happened was there was a few problems with this strategy. Number one, he was really hot in the first half. I mean, especially in the second quarter when they were down and they came all the way back. Look, they were down. He goes out of his mind and they're still down 2 at half. So you got to think to yourself, okay, he literally didn't miss a shot in the last 5 minutes of the half and they're still down 2. So when he starts missing, which he did in the third and fourth quarters, you got him, except for the fact that they overreacted. So, what would happen is he comes across half court and they run a second guy at him, or, which was way worse, Jokic would come over and set a high ball screen. They would double it and he would just make a nice little pocket pass right there to Joker, and then Joker would take a dribble or two, attack, or find a wide open shooter. And then they finally made shots. Grant hit a couple, Millsap hit a couple, Harris hit a couple, and all of a sudden, now they're rolling. So there was a couple problems with this, and again, the first one is they were getting positive variance in the first half. You know, maybe Denver was nervous, maybe, you know, they just weren't in rhythm, whatever the case may be, they missed shots. But they're not going to miss shots forever. These guys, anyone can make a wide open three. And so they started making wide open threes. And so there's your, that's variance. That's one big factor. The second big factor is that when they double teamed Murray, they really didn't put any pressure on him. They stood a few feet off of him and they just put their hands up and kind of just stood there. So he could survey the floor and he could make the same pocket pass to Jokic at the free throw line. And so if you're going to double a guy, if you're going to try to take a ball out of a guy's hands, especially a smaller guy like him, you got to put pressure on him so he cannot make these easy passes. Because now what happens is, they even said on the broadcast, now it's 4-on-3. And you have your best playmaker at the free throw line with the ball making plays. And that's just a positive expectation for Denver and something that they're over the course of the second half, they're going to kill you with that. So the first thing I thought they should have done was put more pressure on him, try to get some deflections, make Jokic catch the ball way higher up so that he couldn't, you know, with more pressure, it would have made for tougher passes and given them more time to get back to it. The second thing that really bothered me was he made the same pocket pass every single time. And nobody thought to take a step over and get cut off that lane, cut off that pass. So maybe you don't have the best angle when you're coming at him, but now you're taking away that simple pass to Jokic where Jokic can turn and make a play. So if one guy kind of stood straight in front of him and the other kind of came to the side, now you're almost funneling him to the sideline. And on top of that, you're taking away that pass to Jokic. So I think that would have been more effective. Another thing they could have done, they could have rotated a guy from the weak side straight over to Jokic early so he couldn't make that pass to him, right? You know your team, you see the ball screen coming, they do it every possession. So why not rotate that guy over early, and now Murray has to throw a skip pass over two defenders to the weak side, which should give your athletic defenders time to rotate back to a guy who's on the weak side. I think that would have worked as well. Another thing they could have done, instead of doubling off Jokic's guy, just switch that. And if you want to double off basically like Jeremy Grant or Paul Millsap from the side. So now when he gets rid of the ball, what he's doing is he's passing it to the side. Instead of Jokic having the ball in the middle of the floor, which is the worst place that you want an offensive player, especially a great playmaker like him, catching the ball. Now you have a non-playmaker like Grant or Millsap catching the ball on the wing. So now you can start funneling your defenders over to that side. And you're playing on half the court instead of where Jokic can go either direction or drive. So I think all of those things would have been way more effective to take away that high pick and roll. And the thing is, to me, it's like they kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And the Clippers never made an adjustment in the second half. It's like their adjustment at halftime was, okay, we're going to double him every time he gets it. And then when they started getting killed, they never made an adjustment to Denver's adjustment, right? You make the adjustment, you're going to take the ball out of Murray's hands. Okay. Malone calls timeout. He says, okay, Jokic, you go to the high post. When they double, we're going to pocket pass to you and you're going to make plays the rest of the night. Okay. So that works a few times. Now where's Doc Rivers coming back and going, okay, they're doing this and we got to take that away and make somebody else beat us. And they never did that. And that's why, you know, the Clippers didn't even make a run at the end of the game because they were so effective with Jokic getting the ball at the high post. And I personally, what I would have done is what they seemed to do with like 3 minutes to go when the game was over, which is switch everything because they played no bigs, you know. By the end of the game, there was no big guys in the game. They put Morris in and or get through and make Murray take contested one-on-one shots. And look, he's going to make some of them. That's great. But he's going to miss them too. And he's not Damian Lillard yet. I know he's a great scorer. But when they lost the last game to go down 3-1, and Michael Porter Jr. said, this isn't going to work playing with one guy or with two guys. Yeah, he was right. It's not going to beat the Clippers with one or two guys. So make those guys play isolation one-on-one basketball. Take the rest of the team out of play. And you'll win. Instead, They played right into what Michael Porter Jr. said was you have to beat him with a complete team. So what'd they do? They beat him with a complete team. You doubled Murray. He passed to Jokic. Jokic passed to Millsap. Millsap one more to Grant in the corner for a three. That's beating him with the whole team. And that's exactly what Porter was talking about and exactly what the Clippers were taking away, and then they stopped doing it. So I would have just said, hey, I'm going to put Beverly on him. He's going to just guard him. He's going to dog him and make him make a bunch of shots with Beverly draped all over him. Because, yeah, he might make a couple, but he's not going to beat you 1-on-5, which is why the Clippers were up 3-1, because it was literally a two-man show and really a one-man show, because either one of them would just catch the ball and then go by themselves because everybody else stayed home. And now the Clippers switched into this defense where they're rotating, and now all these guys who aren't playmakers are getting these open shots. And I just think it was the wrong strategy. Anyway, that's my thoughts. I hope you got something out of this. We will be back probably right after the NBA Finals to discuss who won, who lost, what's going to happen with this, what's going to happen with that, and hopefully the beginning of the college season. My team is scheduled to start practice on October 5th. It's very exciting. We have not been approved yet to play games in the fall, but we have a conference schedule already ready for January and February, as if the coronavirus is going to disappear in January and February, but it's going to be rampant in October, November, and December. So anyway, I'll let you know what's going on with that, and hopefully we can get some college and high school basketball going as well. So that's it. Hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you next time.